I started this podcast with the intention to bring you magnetism from the world of lots of different women and men in various backgrounds. And what I love about today's guest is her realness and the responsibility that she speaks of in terms of her own journey within business. There is no fluff, and she talks about failing as a revelation and an opportunity to move forward and learn. I also love that, much like me, she is spirituality meets spreadsheets, and she really has a lovely spiritual perspective which helps her keep that abundant mindset day to day. So without further ado, here is episode 3 of The Magnetic Woman. Hello and welcome to The Magnetic Woman podcast. I'm Pandora Paloma, life and business coach for women. I'm an author, speaker, mum of one, an all-round miracle and magnetism supporter. It is my mission to create change, to change how women think and feel, see their power and use their feminine force to become magnetic. I help women to live a life in alignment, elevate their mindset, expand their beliefs, and live their vision in life and business. Now for me, magnetism is about being flexible, resilient, in tune with intuition, and really harnessing the power of our mindset and beliefs with aligned action. It's learning to let life flow, not always striving and pushing, but also learning to be open to receiving in new and magical ways. This podcast is a sprinkle of magnetic energy from my corner of the world to yours. If you've listened to the previous episode, you'll know that this series focuses on the topic of money. And today I have a really interesting guest. Her name is Fleur Emery, and she is a startup expert. She hosts business events at The Wing, and she is a columnist at Courier Magazine. So welcome, Fleur.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about you and your background in business and the kind of businesses that you've worked for and in what capacity?
Sure. So about 15 years ago, my sister and I started a porridge business, an instant pot porridge business. You know, those sort of little portable pot porridges you can buy. Me and my sister kind of invented that by accident from home. And it was a long time ago when there was no, I mean, the internet had barely been invented, and there certainly weren't many, there wasn't a startup scene. So we were out in the wilderness making it up. But we had a lot of success, and it got sold in Waitrose and on aeroplanes and on Eurostar and in fancy hotels. And so we grew that business for half a dozen years, had lots of ups and downs through the recession of 2008, was it? And then I did another startup. So I was a founder and owner of that business. Founder and owner again, second time round, of a craft beer brand called Green and Pleasant, which was a lovely project. And I crowdfunded that. Crowdfunding had just post-recession in response to the, you know, financial situation going on. Then crowdfunding had been created by some clever people. So we crowdfunded that. And had investors, and again, that was a lovely project that did really well. And I sold the beer in the Ritz Hotel and lots of other fancy, fine places. And all the way through, I've also worked in a kind, loosely in a kind of coaching capacity, or as a non-executive director on other people's startups, often food, but sometimes fashion or services, and helped other people through sort of difficult time, usually the beginning, the setup. Normally what I'm hired to do is to sort of nose out opportunities, to flex viability of people's ideas and to help them get products or services to market. And that's what I do. And then last year I just spent another 3 years setting up another startup, a food startup, and then decided not to run it and sort of retired from it all. And now I hang out with my kid a lot. I do media work. I'm building an Instagram profile. I work with brands. I host events, and life suddenly got a lot easier.
Incredible. What do you think, so the focus of this podcast as a series is really to look at money and relationship, women's relationship to money in life and business, really. I'm kind of interested mostly in what sort of working on, obviously on your own brands and with other brands that you've consulted with, what it's taught you about money and the different routes to revenue within business.
So in terms of how to fund a business, when my sister and I started our first business, I mean, we weren't even in conversations like this. We didn't have any idea that you needed to sit down and plan how much money you needed and, you know, decide how much of your own money you were going to spend and how much money you were going to take in from outside and when. That just was, you know, completely not in our minds at that point. We just sort of started and then got a larger and larger overdraft, made more and more sales, had unplanned expenditure. It was a mess financially in that way. We just sort of kept putting our own money in, family money, plugging holes, and then having big wins like getting supermarket listings. And so it's suddenly, we just had this idea that suddenly this money tap would be turned on and everything would be okay. So there was a lot of naivety, and I didn't understand the difference between a scale-up business like that, when you basically just, everything goes back into the company, you build it on the hope that one day you might, you know, sell it for a life-changing amount of money. I didn't understand the difference between that and a lifestyle business. And yeah, I mean, you know, I've learned a lot, put it that way. And then, of course, there weren't funding options for small businesses then. People just kept saying, I'll go to the bank to get a loan. And we just go and see loads of middle-aged men in grey suits who just, you know, I mean, just they may have well have been speaking Japanese. It was just a complete culture mismatch. And they didn't understand us and we didn't understand them. So we had really bad relationships with the banks. We were just scrabbling around in the dark, really. And luckily, after that recession, by the time I got round to doing the beer company, you know, I was much more clued up. I had much more experience. I'd had, you know, some investors on the first project that, you know, hadn't been a brilliant relationship. On the second project, I had great investors, and many of them, because we crowdfunded it. The whole kind of landscape was different by then, and there was just masses more information and many more options. And, of course, the amazing SEIS scheme, which has just been an absolute boon for small businesses, you know, because it's just such a great tax break for investors.
Amazing. And what do you think, I mean, given the recession, what do you feel like the biggest sort of business challenge was at that time? And did you find a way to sort of overcome it?
The biggest challenge was that at that time, the banks behaved really badly in a way that they probably wouldn't be able to now. We had a large overdraft at the bank that was secured against my sister's house. And the bank basically phoned us up and said we couldn't have it anymore. Mm. And that just put an enormous amount, you know, listen, I stand up on stages in front of rooms full of novice entrepreneurs and I tell this story and they all cry into their cornflakes and say, oh, you got kicked around. But listen, I signed for the overdraft in the first place. And that sort of, it happened on my watch, you know, so I have to take responsibility for the fact that I didn't manage the business financially very well. It was because I didn't know any better, but still, you know, from my side, it wasn't a really appropriate way to fund a business, to have a big overdraft like that. And then they just behaved badly by deciding overnight that we were a bad risk because of what was happening in the city. Mm. And just said, right, we're going to switch it off. So that just was just like turning the gas up underneath us. And we had a month or two to run around. And, you know, in this period of huge financial uncertainty and get people on board financially with the business. Mm. And again, we didn't know what we were doing. So we were, you know, we were in a very vulnerable position. And, you know, it's not ideal. It's funny because as you get older, you learn all these lessons, but simultaneously I've lost my bite in terms of my sort of ambition and drive to have a startup of my own and be covered in glory and have a big win. You know, I've lost that now. And but then I've got all the knowledge that if I did do it, I'd probably do a much better job.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you learn from the mistakes along the way. I think, you know, it's so often people are like, how do you make it work? And it's, you know, no, there's no one magic formula to running a business, is there?
That's right.
We do what we can, and we, I think, in, you know, failing along the way, actually, that's where our biggest learnings come in. So, and it's interesting because you mentioned sort of the idea of a lifestyle business, and I've seen this quite a lot recently in terms of, you know, the way that women specifically are doing business. And actually, I think a lot of us are creating businesses that, that support our lifestyles, i.e. support, you know, the fact that we can pick up our children from school or not work every, you know, every hour under the sun. And do you think that this is something that is important in the time that we're living in terms of, you know, women just work in a very different way, and actually they're looking for something that supports their lifestyle versus, you know, making that kind of fast buck?
I'm not sure if I differentiate it between sort of women and men. I mean, I've met plenty of women who behave in a sort of archetypally male way in, you know, in the world of work, but I mean, I can say for me, you know, I'm a mum. I had a kid on my own 4 years ago, and I didn't know what kind of mum I was going to be. You know, I thought maybe I would be one of those super ambitious mums who, you know, has a nanny and rushes around and changes the world. But actually, I didn't turn out to be like that at all. And I really want to be home for my kid. And I don't work very much now. And the challenge of it is how to do work that I enjoy and that pays enough money to keep the show on the road. And I'm pretty much doing it. My daughter's at school 4 days a week, 9 till 3. And I do all my, well, when we're not having a pandemic, but, and I do all my work within that time. Mm. So it's not many hours.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my daughter's not at school, so I get the luxury of being able to drop her off at 8 a.m. and pick her up at 5, 4 days a week. But my friends who do have children at school say by the time you've dropped them off and come back and then sat down, had a coffee, you know, it's only sort of 4 or 5 hours. You've got to start thinking about getting up, you know, and picking them up from school. So, you know, that window becomes quite small. But I think it's brilliant if you can make it work. And I think a lot of that for me always comes from, you know, certainly with the women that I work, this belief that actually we can have it all, we just can't necessarily do it all, you know, if we want.
But you can have, you can have it all, but not all at the same time. Yeah. You know, I've had glory and awards and huge sort of professional highs and excitement. And now at the moment, you know, there's a time to dance and a time to gather stones together. And, you know, at the moment, I'm gathering a lot of stones.
Yeah.
It's quiet. And, it's lovely. It's really, in terms of the thing of like, you know, school drop off and sit down and have a cup of coffee. I don't sit down and have a cup of coffee. I can tell you that. You know, I'm ruthlessly efficient. The way that I curate my life and my activities, everything that I do, I think, is that taking me, like, I have an idea of how I want our life to be in my mind, and every single activity of my day I will be thinking, does this take me towards or away from that goal?
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm really very focused. I know exactly how much money I need to generate for us to live. I don't drink. I'm asleep at 9:30 every night with the Archers. I get up in the morning. You know, I exercise. I'm on it. So I think you can have it, but behind the scenes you have to be willing to pay the bill.
Yeah, it's knowing what you can do now. And actually, one of the things that I wake up to is, who do I choose to be today? Like, the choices that, yeah, I make, the action, exactly, that I take is going to get me to where I need to get to. And I'm definitely with you on that. You know, I drop my daughter off. I could do it at 9 o'clock, but I do it at 8 because actually it means that I can get some exercise in pre 9 o'clock and still be at my desk, you know, and I don't do the social things, you know, on my working day. I save that for the weekend. And I think, you know, it's because my time is precious and I love my job and I want to be able to service my clients, and I only get, you know, a certain level of time. So, yeah, I think, you know, knowing what you can do now and knowing that actually that's within your control in terms of the choices that you're making. And
of course, everything that I'm describing comes from a position of great privilege. That I've had a great career, I had a great education, I've got a lot of self-confidence. A lot of people hire me to do different things for small amounts of money, so I can get hired quite easily. So I've got masses and masses of choices. There are some things that I've had to go over the side. Like, I think when we become mums, you get this enormous connection and meaning and sense of placement in the world. But the price is that, you know, or you know those memes you see on things when it's like, you can do anything. Well, I can't do anything. I mean, I know that. You know, there's a lot of things now that I will never do. I've never been to Asia. It's unlikely that I will go and travel extensively in Asia. Mm. It's just unlikely. You know, the way it is, you know, her and me and how old, you know, I had her when I was 42. So by the time she needs money for university and stuff, you know, there's a lot of things. You know, I really would have liked to live in New York City. And I've been there, you know, twice, 2 weekends. So I don't, you know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of hopes and dreams that are no longer available. Mm. But where I do sit in my life, I feel a lot of gratitude and I have a lot of choices and privileges. And, you know, we're in a very safe place. Mm. It's pretty nice. I think it's kind of to do with how we see it. Like every day it's sort of to do with our point of view, right? Yeah. Our mindset about
exactly it. The perspective. You can either see it from the left side or the right side, and that can be very different. Mm. But and I think I went to a talk once and someone was saying, you know, that we are limitless, but we do have limits. As women, we have limits, and that can be our monthly cycle, which means that there are some days of the month where, you know, you want to kill everything in sight, and that becomes a limit for you. And things like being a mother, it's like, I absolutely couldn't go and take 6 months off right now. That's just being very realistic. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's that sort of element of realism. You know, I always say anything's possible if you believe it's possible, but you couldn't believe that going to Asia for 6 months is possible if you have a 5-year-old. Do you know what I mean? That isn't possible at this point. So it's sort of, yeah, knowing your boundaries and knowing your limits, I suppose.
And understanding like why we want to do things. So this latest startup that I parked, that I decided not to do, that was, you know, had a range of products that were ready to go and Sainsbury's wanted them, and potentially it could have made me like an enormous amount of money. And there was various really compelling reasons why I didn't want to do it. You know, it's part of the meat industry and it was with plastic packaging, and there'd been such a shift in consciousness, including mine, that I didn't, you know, I didn't want to do it. But I think it's about accepting sometimes that, you know, the old rabbit that I was chasing was glory and status and ego. And in the context of now, like reviewing that as a parent, those things don't have the same meaning. And, you know, that's not what I want to be chasing anymore. So I had to kind of like stop chasing the rabbit and just say, okay, I'm going to stop now. Mm. And it might not be my story. I'm not maybe going to be, you know, businesswoman of the year with a 10 million quid exit. That's not, because that, we don't need 10 million pounds. We don't even need £1 million. We just need time together. Yeah. And so sometimes it's just about checking in with ourselves and thinking, why am I actually doing that? Why am I chasing that number? What does that mean? And what am I losing to get it?
Yeah. What does that number represent? And actually I had a client the other day say that she'd focused on a number for so long, and she just had this realization that the number was irrelevant, because actually what was important was what the number provides for her, which is time with her children and holidays and you know, that sort of preciousness. And she was like, I stopped thinking about the number and started really thinking about how, you know, the intention, and things started to flow a bit better. It's almost like she was blocking herself in the process by only focusing on the number, which I think, you know, it can be quite easy to do.
And what can happen is that we can get triggered by things. So I have this thing that happens in my career, which is funny, that a couple of times a year I'll get headhunted by a big corporate business that wants someone entrepreneurial on their board or something. And they phone me up and they say, oh, you know, it's Land Rover or whoever, come and, you know, we want you to come and interview for this thing. And I say, listen, you think you want me, you definitely don't want me. I'm not a match. And then they say, oh, but we'll give you a Land Rover and we'll give you 100 grand. And then I'm like, oh, shit. But I want to work from home. They're like, well, you can work from home. And I was like, oh, my God. And then by the time I'm like 3 interviews in and I'm an expert on the future of transportation and the motor industry, I don't even know if I want, you know, I don't want to work for Land Rover, but it's miles away since I've actually had that thought. I'm in the race, you know, like a jockey whacking the horse and just looking over his shoulder, flicking his head back, you know, because I'm so competitive. I just want it by that point. And I don't know if it's right for me. I've completely lost sight of all that, but I'm just like after the win. So I have to like keep an eye on myself and just sometimes have a word with myself and just say, what is it that you're chasing? Why do you want that? And sometimes it's like childhood stuff and it's about, I want people to think this about me. I want, you know, I want to be seen as this. And those things, like as a parent, those things are not meaningful. They have to go, because it doesn't matter if the outside world think I'm a great businesswoman. What it matters is my kid, you know, thinks I'm a decent person. So like with this company that I've just binned off, you know, if we'd have hit our targets, we would have produced 6 million pieces of plastic packaging in 3 years. And I was walking, you know, down the beach, you know, my kid is chasing a plastic bag to make sure it doesn't go in the water. And I'm about to try and, you know, leave her with someone so that I can go and make 10 million quid selling plastic. Mm-hmm. Just doesn't add up. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Completely. It's always about what it's teaching us, which lends quite nicely to my next question. Obviously, we're going through, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic right now, and it would be crazy for me to not ask your opinion on what you think this will teach us about money, or how you think this will affect businesses, because of course, I mean, come on.
I mean, I see my, I'm a business expert. I wouldn't say I'm a money expert. And you probably be, if you look back at how I financially handled my businesses before, it's been, you know, I've made a bit of a mess of it, you know? So I can't say that, you know, I'm a bit of a spendthrift. I just slosh it around a bit when I've got it. So I'm not sure I'm the best person to sort of predict. I can tell you what my hopes are. My hopes are that the culture of insatiable consumerism typified by the Kardashians or the Beckhams or, you know, that is over. You know, I hope that, you know, Topshop goes bust and does not reopen. And I hope that people change the way they spend money and buy less, and that, you know, electronic items becoming obsolete so that we're required to buy a new one, that, you know, people wake up to these kind of things, and that we go back a step. That's what I hope, but we'll see. And maybe I'm dreaming, and maybe I'm, you know, saying, you know, broadcasting that from my ivory tower, you know, that's also quite possible with my cashmere dressing gown or whatever.
Yeah, I think it will, my hope as well is that it will kind of allow people the time to think about their values and how they consume, you know, even if it's just on a really sort of, you know, minute level. But the hope is that, yeah, we look at it. I mean, you know, I can only say this for myself. You know, I was saying to you earlier, my lifestyle hasn't necessarily changed that much. I mean, I'm normally in London half the week. I'm not there. Actually, I'm loving it because I get to be at home all week. I work from home, so nothing's drastically changed. But, you know, I've even gone, okay, well, I should probably think about, you know, really limiting what I'm spending in terms of food. And I've actually looked at, you know, what I was spending going back and forth to London. And it you know, and I'm always hot on what I'm spending, but it was a real, like, actually, I'm going to be able to not spend that amount. And that is kind of interesting in itself, really, to look at kind of, you know, where we spend, basically. I'm really interested in why you feel it's so important. I mean, you know, I work solely with women, and I know that you have worked with.
I mostly do these days. That's who I'm interested in, you know, in terms of female founders are the people who I want to get behind. Yeah. To give them the help that I didn't have, you know, that's kind of my goal.
Yeah. And why do you think, you know, I feel like now it's becoming increasingly important that women are opening up that conversation around money. And I'd love to know why you believe that it's so important from, you know, from your point of view.
Because middle-aged white guys, you know, keep it all otherwise, right?
Been running it for too long.
Which isn't fair. And it's all just a house of cards. It's all just absolute nonsense. And it's not because they're clever enough than us, just because they have this sense of entitlement. And it pisses me off. It's just, as you can hear, it's a bit of a, it touches a bit of a nerve.
Bit of a yeah.
I've just had so many people in my career, so many rich men who, with MBAs, tell me that I'm not doing things right. And so many women around me who have great ideas and great skills and undervalue themselves and underplay themselves, while absolute nitwit men cream off all the money. And it's just boring now. Yeah. On the good side, you know, I just got a lovely little job as the agony aunt for a new magazine by a women's networking group called the Coven Girl Gang, and all these kids in their 20s with tattoos and pointy nails. And they're all just great, really smart kids opening. I mean, they're not kids, they're grown women, but, you know, they're half my age. And they're just so much more astute and savvy than I was. There's a whole load of them now coming up who don't see barriers and just impress me so much. I love working with them. It's just, yeah, it's really inspiring. There's an army of them and they're on their way. So yeah, I know. It's over, rich old white guys.
Yeah, I know it well. I'm literally sat at my dining room table with a copy of the Coven magazine. Great. That the founder sent to me literally yesterday, and it's
great. Yeah, Sapphire is amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
She's really impressive entrepreneur, and there's a lot going on, and yeah, they're not being told no.
Yeah, changing the narrative, you know. I'd love to know about your sort of personal money story as a woman in business and a solo mum. You know, are you a saver, an investor? You know, how have you, and also if there's one specific person who helped you specifically with your own sort of management and understanding of money.
I can say that I definitely have an abundance mentality when it comes to money. So I'm a great sharer. I don't ever worry about money, and I have great resources and believe in myself. So, you know, when I never worry that I can't support myself. Like if you drop me into another country where I couldn't speak the language, you know, I'd find some way to get hired and make some money and be happy doing it. So I like to work and I like to earn small bits of money. I'm not money focused in terms of I haven't accumulated wealth, and I don't really particularly approve of a lot of investment business, like buying properties and becoming a landlord and things like that. I don't believe that property should be used as cash point machines when we've got people asleep in the road, for example. I don't believe that people should be allowed to buy a whole terrace of houses or a block of flats and profit from it. Well, I'm quite lo-fi in my financial sophistication, but I'm a good earner and I'm a good sharer, and I sleep, you know, with my head on the pillow every night without worrying about it. And I mean, I could be describing my dad. My dad just has a great attitude, and he's always earned loads of money, paid loads of tax, and just shared all the money out. And he's never sought to avoid tax. He's never sought to take part in any kind of sharp aggressive money growth situations. He's just sailed on his boat and eaten his sausage roll and lived his happy life. Mm. And so I would say that he's been my role model financially in that way. I don't want my life to be about money. I want, you know, want my life to be about moments with people, and I want enough money so that I can be in those moments.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm wholeheartedly with you on that one. You talked about sort of that abundance mindset, and it's something I teach quite a lot with sort of the mindset work that I do with women. And I'm always interested whether that's something that you learn. Obviously, you said your dad was a role model. So was that something that you just very naturally learned from him, or was it something that you perhaps cultivated with practice, but, you know, knowing that that was, you know, something that, that you know, the way that he lived? Have you always been like that, or did it sort of take a bit of work? Have you ever had doubts, basically?
I mean, I've always been an optimistic person, and I've always been a good sharer. And so I've never had fear of financial insecurity. You know, when you scrimp on money and you worry about it and you don't want to lend your friend a pound. But I would say that I'm an addict, and I'm 19 years in clean and sober. And when I went into NA and cleaned up after a sort of significant mental health crisis in the end of the millennium, I did masses of work on myself then. And a lot of it was to do with like acceptance, knowing yourself, you know, getting a spiritual perspective, and all of those kind of 12-steppy things, which I've continued to do, have really served me well in this department. And of course, you'll know that there's a lot of crossover when you read about sort of abundance mindset and things like that, or you read about stoicism, or you believe about, or you know, there's all kinds of different things where there's a sort of a crossover. And you know, my particular flavor of it came from the 12-step program, because that's where I did the majority of my work 20 years ago. But I do, you know, sometimes you have to, I keep my eye on it. I have a daily, you know, process of reflection and gratitude and observation. I mean, I don't sit down and meditate, but I definitely have a spiritual perspective which I upkeep, which sort of, you know, helps me stay on that track. Having said that, recently this whole pandemic thing has kind of triggered me, and I had a bit of a little relapse in this way of thinking. My kids' school, which is a fee paying, I got paid a bit of money on a big gig that I did a while ago, and I paid the fees up until September. And the policy of the school, now the school's closed, is that they're not refunding the money. And I got quite triggered by that. And I kind of was listening to the news and listening to everyone saying small businesses are going to get help from the government, but freelancers aren't. And I kind of got a head of steam up, and I spoke to the school, and I sort of was feisty about it. And I was just like, you know, and giving them a good argument on why this was. And then I realized that evening that I just didn't feel very nice. I felt like a bit hungover. I felt a bit yucky, and had a think and a pray and a sleep, and a, you know, had a croissant. And after that, frozen croissants, the way to survive the pandemic, she said from her ivory tower. And when I woke up the next morning, I just thought, that's not me. Like, I'll be fine. I don't need help from the government. You know, I don't need much to live on. We can live off 600 quid a month. I can make 600 quid a month. You know what I mean? On the internet, it's like, calm down, Fleur. What are you doing? Calm down. Plus, Fleur, you want the school to be there. It's a beautiful school where she's extremely happy. You don't want to pressurize them now. They're under enough pressure. You don't want them to go bankrupt. And I phoned them and I apologized. And I said, I wasn't myself. I was feeling very anxious yesterday. Mm. I don't want to put pressure on you. I want the school to go on. I don't want you to go bankrupt. And I'd be delighted for you to keep that money. And I look forward to my daughter coming back there. And I really meant it.
Yeah.
You know, I paid that money ages ago. It's not like I'm missing it, like I need it today.
Yeah, exactly. And I think...
But it's just, that's just a mindset. It's just like, have the money, keep the, you know, I trust you. I trust the school. They behave well. They're a nice school. They're not robbing me. Why am I saying they're robbing
me? Yeah. It's living, you know, with love and not fear. And actually, you said it, you know, you have that sort of spiritual toolbox in a sense. And that's, you know, I feel like I'm always saying that to clients. It's like, you know, everything I'm telling you is stuff that you'll learn and keep forever. you know, and there'll be times that you're triggered. Of course, I think this pandemic is triggering a lot of things and opening us up in ways that perhaps we weren't quite ready for. But equally, we've got the tools in the toolbox. So let's just make sure that we give them. And you mentioned, you know, gratitude. And actually, you know, that in itself is saying to the school, do you know what? Actually, no, keep it. I'm grateful for you and what you give to my daughter day to day. So you know what? We'll be okay over here. Let's refocus the energy somewhere else. And, you know, again, that's just, it's a mindset shift, isn't it? You know, it's a reframe.
It's also step 10. It's a step 10. So yeah. What's really interesting about being triggered by a pandemic is the toolkit is all very well, but you have to, like, you have to keep it up to date every day. So if you have those habits, like every morning you meditate, or every morning you light a candle and say, please, gonna have a good day, whatever it is, or every morning you cycle around the block and look at a tree, whatever. If you've been doing it regularly, when the shit hits the fan, you know, you have it in your routine. So I've been every morning and every evening for like 19 years, I've been doing this, you know, the same recap in my mind. How do I feel? You know, am I okay with my actions? And because of that, that night when I was tweaking, I'd had a ruck with them, you know, I reviewed and recapped and I just thought, yeah, actually, I don't feel that great. Why don't I feel that great? Whereas, you know, you have to have that routine in place so that when the hard times come, you still keep doing those things and you still keep reviewing, because otherwise you just go down the rabbit hole. Yeah. And it becomes real. You just, you know, your perception is that that scarcity is real. And what's, I think, the best thing I ever taught, and this again was in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, someone explained to me the difference between financial insecurity and fear of financial insecurity. So you have people who have a huge bank account full of money, but they experience on a daily basis a fear of financial insecurity and are constantly trying to get more money in the hope that someday they'll have so much money that they'll feel happy. And it's, you know, so it's not financial security. It's something, I don't have fear of financial insecurity, which is, you know, which is great. I'm really happy. But it's kind of unrelated to how much money we've got, is what I'm saying. It's a, again, it's just a mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said about sort of, you know, building the habit, but repetition builds the habit. And
yeah, really, really
by doing that, even when shit hits the fan and you feel challenged or triggered, you don't go back straight back to that place, because you've repeated the same thing. Like you said, your morning practice, your evening practice, it builds that habit. So you might go a step back, but you're not going to go 100 steps back because you've built a new habit.
And it's like you clear your mess up as you go along. Like obviously calling the school and making that call and saying sorry, yeah, that's not, you know, that's not going to feel great, but you just, I always will do it because I know what I've got to lose, you know, my sobriety, my peace of mind that I work really hard for. And so there's nothing I won't take back, there's nothing I won't apologize for. If someone, you know, accuses me of doing something, I will hold my hands up and I'll have a think about it. And I'll just say, have I done that? Am I that person? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, tidying up as you go along is just a great habit, because then you can be free again.
Yeah, completely. As my girlfriend would say, excuse my French, but she's like, own your shit. And it's true. It's like, don't play the victim here. If you've done something that you don't feel good about, then acknowledge it, apologize and move on. You know, it's like if you harbor that guilt, it's going to feel much worse. So actually, by saying, do you know what, I apologize about that, it means that you're releasing it and you're giving gratitude and thanks to that person for, you know, dealing with you not owning your shit. And then you're showing up and saying, I'm going to show up for myself right now and say that I did do that, but I'm, you know, but I'm sorry, and now's the time to move on. And you know, I think it's something that, I mean, I certainly know from someone who used to play the victim quite a lot, like, it's not me, it's them. It's like, it gets you nowhere. So actually,
and it's just so painful. You're describing the life of a drug addict. It's just like, you know, poor me, poor me. It's just so painful. It's a horrible place to live.
Yeah,
exactly. It's just awful.
So, Fleur, if there was one thing that you wished every woman knew about money, what would it be?
Oh God, you can't answer that question and not just sound like an entitled twat. I don't know. Do you know? I can only talk about myself. I just couldn't give financial, you know, pass. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. And what does being a magnetic woman, so for me, you know, magnetism means different things to different people, but what does it being a magnetic woman mean specifically to you?
To me, women who I find really magnetic, the one thing they have in common is that they're really being themselves and they're singing their own song. You know, it applies to men as well. And I just, that, you know, the charisma that comes when a person is really just doing their own thing and making their own kind of music, that's for me what it's all about. And, you know, I try to do that. And, you know, the dangers you see when we do it is that it magnetizes people, but also violently repels other people. And so you have to kind of, you have to take the rough with the smooth and stop trying to make everyone love you. I just say, I'll love me. I'll be myself. You know, I'll try and be the best, you know, a decent human being and, you know, find my song. And it's a work in progress. But that when I meet really interesting women, that's what they have in common. Yeah.
Lovely way to finish, and I'm wholeheartedly with you on that one. So where can people find you?
So my new natural habitat, after avoiding social media for 15 years, I'm now a diehard Instagrammer and actually loving it. I'm a very late adopter. I only went on 60 months ago, and now I'm posting daily. I'm broadcasting all kinds of things, interviewing all kinds of interesting people. So definitely join me there for free content and support and news to do with female entrepreneurship, starting businesses, growing businesses, all that kind of chit-chat.
Amazing.
Also, if you're a Wing member, I do events at the Wing and Courier Magazine and Coven.
Brilliant. I have been watching your Instagram journey. And do you know the one thing that really, like, kind of, I was so drawn to with you was just that honesty and, you know, no bullshit approach, basically. It's like, this is who I am. I'm new to this and here's what I know. And I thought it was very refreshing and it just felt very authentic to me. So,
great. And you get to meet lovely people, you know, like you. It's just, I didn't go on Instagram to make friends. You know, I went on there to raise my profile in order to sort of do a podcast or get better media gigs. You know, I'd like to have a radio show, you know, these kind of things. But, you know, the side effect is that I've met masses of great women and made some lovely friends in a short period of time. So what a bonus. Yes,
exactly, exactly. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I'll make sure that your Instagram handle and everything else is in the notes within the podcast. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Coming into episode 3. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Just a couple of things to finish from me. If you did enjoy the podcast, I would so appreciate you leaving a review and subscribing so that you can check in for next week's episode where I'm going to be talking about money and manifesting. If you are also interested in really uncovering your relationship with money and healing your money story and learning to relate to money in a way that feels fun, easy and authentic, then I am launching a magnetic money course, a 30-day life-changing course exploring practical money management, money mindset, and money magnetism. So head to the show notes to get all of the juicy details. Lots of love from me, and tune in next week.